You're listening to Upfront. I'm Salima Hamarani. Burning homes, rape, and indiscriminate murder. These are the troubling stories told by Rohingya Muslim refugees fleeing a brutal military crackdown in Burma's Rakhine State that started at the end of August. Upwards of 250,000 Rohingya have fled Burma, also known as Myanmar, in the last 2 weeks. They are heading towards crowded and squalid camps in Bangladesh, camps that are quickly running out of resources. We spoke to a Rohingya human rights activist inside Burma to hear about the situation there since the most recent eruption of violence. For safety reasons, we're unable to use her real name on air. So to start, you are currently in Burma, is that correct?
Right.
And what's the situation in Burma at the moment with Rohingya?
Situation is very serious. From August 25th, so there was an alleged attack against the police stations by a militia group, and the military has launched disproportionate crackdown against the entire community. So they're basically launchers and setting fire, shooting people, slaughtering. A lot of this abuse is ongoing, according to the ground information reports that we have been receiving. So far, according to the government information, it's about 50 village has been burned, and the government say it's by the terrorists, so-called terrorists or militia, but according to the villagers, it's by the military. It is very difficult to measure how the scale of the atrocities, but it is utterly severe. People have fled to the Bangladesh, and a lot of the people who are trying to cross the border from Budirong and Mongdol, which is a bit far from the border. A lot of the people are basically dying because they become physically very weak to walk to the border. And like mostly like children and women and elderly people who cannot walk anymore, they just left them, and many of them are dying on their way to the border or crossing the border. And almost all people who are living in northern Rakhine State has finished their food supplies. Everything has shut down for 12 days now. People from the city cannot send like food supplies to the villages. So it's really, really terrible situations. People have no food. People are getting sick and diseases, and there is no medical care or any doctor at all.
So the Burmese government and Aung San Suu Kyi have maintained that the reports coming out of the refugee camps from survivors of rape and of murder, of burned villages, they're saying that it's all made up, it's not real. How would you respond to them?
I mean, until they have allowed the international media and domestic media, independent media, to access to the area, it is really difficult for us who is committing the crimes. But obviously, according to the villagers, according to the people in the ground, their villages have been burned. They have witnessed people are killed, and you know, people are slaughtered, people are shot dead, and they cannot get any aid, or they cannot send food to each other's village without access to the independent media and access to the free information. So it is extremely hard to verify what is really going on. But there are some media who has been going to the Bangladesh side and talking to the victims and putting out the voice, victim voice, in the international media.
Have Rohingya always faced this level of discrimination in Burma? Has it always been like this?
According to our experience, the Rohingya has been discriminated for at least 3 decades. And after 2012, about 150,000 people, after a riot in 2012, about 150,000 people were displaced, and they were put in the camps, living in an apartheid-like condition in squalid camps. And, you know, the entire community have been facing more and more discriminations and segregations from the rest of the entire Burmese populations, including like restrictions on their livelihood, their employment, their professional, their educations, healthcare, food, and movement, marriage. It has been there, but this is like the worst, because these situations become like a war against the civilian by the army or military with big weapons, where most of the civilian unarmed. There hasn't been any evidence of terrorist act as it is out in other countries.
Are you worried for yourself? Being Rohingya, are you worried about your safety?
Of course, all Rohingya are worried of their safety right now.
You say there has always been discrimination against Rohingya, but it became worse recently. What's causing the hatred against Rohingya?
I think it's because of the impunity that has been given to people who have been spreading hate speech. It's become natural to insult or to attack this group. It has also been echoed sometimes by the government officials itself, and that's encouraged the public more. In my opinion, it's not about people hating each other. It's institutions where discriminatory policy has imposed and where there is lack of protections for the minority, and that enable and encourage majority to hate each other. It's about the discriminations and prosecutions and targeted systematic actions against one group.
Have you talked to survivors from the northern area, from Rakhine? How are they feeling and where are they going? Are they leaving Burma? Do you want to leave Burma?
We've talked to some witnesses and some survivors. My family itself is a survivor. My grandma's house is burned. Her village is burned. And she is running away. She's like 87. She was with two little granddaughter and daughter-in-law. And her son and her grandson was arrested last year, October 25th, with the accusations of associating with this militia group, where my uncle and my cousin has nothing to do with them and no affiliation with them. And they were just arrested and they were tortured. They're still under the trial without fair trial. And right now, well, after this event, my grandma village is burned and she's running away. They themselves are survivors now.
How do you see this changing? Do you see any way out of this?
The situation is really, really serious, and there is no protections for the million of people at all. There is zero protections for them. It's a very serious conditions. What you can do is raise more and more awareness, and potentially if more government hear, then we can save some life. If not, if we're late, it will be really hard. The situation will be very hard.
This current crisis is a continuation of violence that erupted in 2012, when homes and entire villages were razed and adults and children shot or hacked to death. The majority of the Rohingya in the state capital, Sitwe, were forced into camps with limited access to food, medical care, employment, or education. They are not allowed to leave. KPFA spoke with a Rohingya Muslim man in the camps in 2015. We are not identifying his name for his protection.
We have no jobs, no human rights. We are unhappily living in this camp. Other community can move everywhere. So we cannot move, we cannot do, we cannot learn. So this condition is like animal. Just our life is like animal's life. My life is destroyed. I'm 38 years old, so I have 4 children. I'm thinking I'm afraid of my children's future life. My life is destroyed. It's no problem. I will die. My children and also other children will be brought. They have no education. So the children are like facing difficult troubles, and also they have no knowledge, and their minds cannot change. So I don't afraid my life. I already destroyed and despoiled. I don't want to despoil and destroy my children's life. How can we get our human right and also our justice?
Last year, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA, attacked police outposts in Rakhine State. In response, the military launched a massive, violent retaliation against the Rohingya and are accused of systematic rape and indiscriminate killing of civilians. The ARSA once again attacked police outposts in August, leading to another violent military response, which created the massive refugee crisis we're witnessing today. Here's the testimony of a young Rohingya woman who fled to the refugee camps in Bangladesh, collected in March of this year. A quick warning, there are mentions of sexual violence and murder.
Suddenly, they entered our village and we tried to hide. Anyone they found was arrested. We were hiding in the paddy field. If they had found us, we would have been arrested and shot. They entered each house and destroyed everything inside. In front of us, they tied a woman and a child from behind and burned them. When people came out from the house, they were tied up and burned. I was raped. Other women were raped too. Two of them held me down while another raped me. I didn't understand their language because they spoke in Rakhine. We were not allowed to talk to each other. They taped our mouths shut.
That testimony was captured by documentary filmmaker and photographer Jean Marie Halasi, who spent decades in Burma. She directed several films about the country and visited the refugee camps in Bangladesh in March of this year. I spoke with her in the studio about the greater context surrounding the violence we're seeing.
So talk to me about the Rohingya. Who are they?
The term Rohingya is not accepted by most people in Burma. Most of the Burmese who are predominantly Buddhist refer to them as Bengali to indicate that they are illegal migrants from Bangladesh, and they are not recognized as one of the official ethnic minority groups within Burma. They are stateless. They have no citizenship. And this is a core issue that leads to a range of other human rights violations against them and the lack of their access to any kind of basic service and this apartheid-style system that they're currently incarcerated, essentially, in these designated camps. There's approximately 1 million Rohingya, and out of Burma's 51 million population, roughly 4% are Muslim. So the Rohingya are Muslim, and they are primarily living in Rakhine State, which is a western state in Burma that borders Bangladesh. It is one of the poorest states in the country, the least developed. Almost 80% live at poverty level, both the Rohingya Muslims and the majority ethnic Rakhine Buddhists who live there. So it's an area of Burma that has long been neglected by the central government. So the most recent violence occurred in 2012. That was then resulted in the separation of all Rohingya Muslim populations who were extracted from the capital of Sitwe and relegated to these cordoned areas, which are camps for what are known as internally displaced persons, or IDPs. So they have been really in this institutionalized segregation, which is also seeped into the psyche of the general population. And late last year, the emergence of this newly formed militant group, or what others have ascribed as a terrorist organization, but what by all reports seems to be a very small group of Rohingya male youth, launched their first attack against Burmese police outposts. And that led to the first mass exodus and severe military operation and repercussions for this attack, which 9 policemen were killed in that attack. What we've just seen in the last few weeks was essentially a replication of what happened at the end of last year. And the UNHCR, the United Nations agency that deals with refugees, is now calling this officially a crisis. They are expecting almost 300,000 refugees. As of now, they said it's about 250,000 who have fled into Bangladesh from Burma as a result of this recent attack.
Can you talk about what type of violence we're talking about? Because so many people have fled.
This group, which renamed itself, and the acronym they're now using is ARSA, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, is reportedly led by a young Rohingya man who actually was raised in Saudi Arabia but is Rohingya by origin, from originally with family roots in Burma, and has returned to the areas in this long border between Bangladesh and what is Rakhine State in Burma. And there is not a lot of information about this group. I do not think that they are very well organized or have large numbers. The border attack that happened last year, the eyewitness report said that included among this small group of men, Rohingya men who attacked the police, some of them were wielding bamboo sticks. So I think it's they do have some arms, but I don't think it's a highly efficient or organized military operation, and certainly not one that could meet the might and the manpower of the Burmese army.
How is the military responding? Because I want to be clear about the type of violence that that people are facing and the reason that they're fleeing.
This, what is called a military operation, was replicated today from what we saw at the end of last year when the exodus happened from that original attack. Human Rights Watch reports, as you've seen, have shown satellite imagery that is documenting widespread areas where entire villages are being burned. The Burmese government and the military specifically is alleging that the Rohingya Muslims are burning their own villages in order to inflame the scale of these reported attacks. But it is clearly evident from all independent investigations that have taken place by human rights institutions as well as journalists that there is a systematic use of rape as a weapon of war. I personally interviewed some young people in Bangladesh, including, they were all teenagers, including girls and a young boy. The girls that I interviewed had both been raped by members of the Burmese army. There is indiscriminate firing in the villages. There have been reports of children as well as adults who have been fired upon. There has been reports of mortar being used and some limited forms of aerial bombardment. Rocket launchers, and the firing upon civilians. So this is all a breach of international law, particularly if there is a group of refugees that are departing an area. It is against international law to fire upon them. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who have now had to flee as a result of this, their houses being burned down. When I went to Bangladesh to interview refugees who had fled then, eyewitnesses that I spoke to said people were being taken out of the house hogtied and then burned alive. So given the track record of the Burmese army's long, long record, grievous and heinous human rights abuses that they have committed, not only in Rakhine State, but in other ethnic areas, I think it's clear that this type of violation is happening now.
And where are the refugees going?
The refugees are primarily fleeing to Bangladesh. They're leaving on land. They're carrying their children and whatever meager belongings they can carry. It's not an easy journey. It often takes them several days. One part of the border is demarcated by a river. So unfortunately, several of the refugees attempting to cross over to Bangladesh drowned in that river whilst crossing.
So talk to me about what it's like for Rohingya living in Burma. Like, what is the material situation that they're in? What sort of violence are they facing? And what is it like to live in the camps?
The conditions in the camps are very rudimentary, and the camps in Sitwe, they only have access to education if there is a school in that area, because not all of the camps have full access to education. There are some humanitarian agencies giving assistance in these camps. That means that there's a provision of basic food supplements from the World Food Program with rice and cooking oil, and there's some basic health services. But in the camps that I visited in Bangladesh on the other side of the border, the Bangladesh government does not recognize all of the Rohingya as refugees. There's only a few official camps, which are governed by the United Nations Refugee Agency. The other camps are what are called makeshift camps. These camps have abysmal conditions. There is the camp that I visited earlier this year in Bangladesh, where the people who had fled from last year's violence, there were three homemade built toilets for about 5,000 people. There was open water sewage that we were walking through, and I actually met some of the UNICEF staff who were coming out of that camp who were reporting waterborne disease among children. So they're extremely crowded, they're dismal, and there's a real sense of despondency, I would say, is the prevailing atmosphere in these camps. And even those camps that have some access to aid, that same atmosphere of hopelessness and just being stuck with absolutely no sense of any future that's possible or a time when you can return home, it's a very heavy, intense, emotional layer that I think hangs throughout the atmosphere.
So some bigger questions here. There's this whole debate about whether or not Rohingya are Burmese or not, which is interesting because there are a lot of ethnic minorities in Burma. And not all of them are indigenous, quote unquote. Why target this particular population?
It's important, I think, that we step back and sort of get a contextual overview of where Rakhine State is strategically in Burma. And for me, to emphasize that the lack of development and the widespread poverty and the discouragement that the Rakhine Buddhists have also felt towards the central government has existed for many, many decades. One of the largest pipelines in Asia being built right now is directly accessing Rakhine State. There is a large deep sea port and special economic zone being built in Cheokpyu, which is one of the coastal areas in Rakhine State. The fact that the land and the access to the land is crucial to these infrastructure projects, and the fact that Rakhine State has always been overlooked by the Central Burmese Authority, has provided this fertile ground to have an easy incendiary device whereby a small match, which can be orchestrated by the military, which has been known to do this in Burma in other ethnic areas, can ignite the conflict that we're seeing now.
So that's, I think it's interesting to me that people would trust the military's versions of what's happening with the Rohingya, knowing as they do how violent and murderous the military has been.
Well, they've been fueled by the ascension of these ultra-nationalist Buddhist groups. There is a self-described monk, Wiratu, who was the leader of this group called Ma Batha. And they were certainly behind much of the propaganda that was being disseminated prior to the 2012, when the 2012 incident took place. And he has since really used that as a platform to continue to stoke fear that the Muslims are going to take over the national religion of Burma, that they are going to intermarry, that they are grabbing land. There's an emotionalism when you start to talk about religion. And when you start to use religion as an emotional shield to distract people from the actual political and human rights situation on the ground, it's very effective, and it's a way to control the population.
And I feel as if people's attention on the government has shifted away onto Rohingya as a scapegoat, and less attention is now being put on dismantling the military government in power.
There are many civil society activists who I know in Burma who would certainly agree with you on that analysis. But again, going back to what I said, when you're coming out of half a century, so 50 years of military rule in what was likened to be one of the most horrific dictatorships in the world, with absolute power and control over a population, second only to North Korea in terms of its Orwellian type infiltration into every aspect of people's lives, then why aren't people calling the military more to task? The military are still in charge in Burma. The 2008 Constitution enshrines and ensures that they will still be in charge. The fact that there is a war in Kachin State, which relatively speaking has far less attention than the conflict in Rakhine State, the fact that there is massive land grabbing going on throughout Burma, many areas of which are directly tied to foreign direct investment and are these new development projects, is certainly, as you said, a distraction from the longer-term goal of what would be a meaningful political change in Burma from military dictatorship. But it's quite easy to get groups fighting one another, which is a convenience in a sense for the military government to go and continue on their way with other plans they have for the extraction and pillaging of resources and land, which I think is happening whilst the attention is focused on this communal violence. I think most of the Rohingya, like most of the Rakhine, are simply trying to survive, you know, have a peaceful life where they are not being interrupted by any form of conflict from whomever, and have an opportunity to survive and have their children get an education, full stop. Small dreams, but tangible ones that even then are not attainable in this current situation.
That was Jean Halisi, documentary filmmaker and longtime Burma specialist, who visited the refugee camps in Bangladesh back in March, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have fled. The Rohingya are the world's largest stateless group. They are not recognized as citizens by the Burmese government and instead considered illegal migrants from Bangladesh. KPFA spoke with another Rohingya Muslim man in the camps about this in 2015.
We are ethnic group in this land. This is our land. Today, They broadcast us. We are illegal Bengali, but we are not illegal Bengali. We are legal Rohingya. We are ethnic group of this Myanmar country, ethnic Rohingya Muslim. So today they broadcast us. We are from Bangladesh. Just they are lying to the history of the world. I don't want to leave my native land.
For folks here in California, Burma may seem half a world away. But what happens here in this country does have an impact on the escalating sentiment against Muslims and how the conflict is viewed. Donald Trump has drawn praise from members of the nationalist anti-Rohingya group Ma Bata in Burma for his Islamophobic statements and proposed Muslim immigration ban. And for their part, the Burmese government has adopted the United States rhetoric in talking about the Rohingya and the ASRA, using language drawn from the War on Terror. For Up Front, I'm Salima Hamarani.